I'm Veronica Dudo in Washington, D.C. tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Historic Days. President Trump faces a unique weekend, a possible Iran peace deal, the World Cup kicks off, and an 80th birthday UFC event. Rocket launch, SpaceX debuts on Wall Street with a record-breaking IPO that could make Elon Musk the world's first trillionaire. Plus, global impact, Pope Leo XIV concludes his historic journey through Spain today, delivering a powerful message on migration. Javier Romero has all the details on the final day of the trip. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, our top story tonight. A senior White House official says a deal with Iran to end the war could be done in just days, adding there's an 80 to 85% chance it will actually happen. It's called a Memorandum of Understanding. Pakistan also says the U.S. and Iran have agreed to the wording of it. At the same time, President Donald Trump today demanded the Islamic Republic better get their act together and fail. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Veronica, on a phone call today with reporters, the senior administration official said the deal is quite simple, but that verification will be needed.
More than 3 months after the war started tonight, the key terms to end it put on paper. It dismantles Iran's nuclear weapons program, including the destruction and moving of enriched material. It reopens the Strait of Hormuz and lifts the blockade. And it guarantees long-term peace in the region. Iran can't fund violence. In return, Iran would be relieved of economic pressure, be reintegrated into the world economy, and as Iranians perform, they get economic relief. Earlier on social media, before the senior administration official briefed reporters, President Donald Trump accused Iran of lying about the details of the agreement, writing, "The terms that Iran leaked out to the fake news have nothing to do with the terms that were agreed to in writing. What they said, including their weak and pathetic statement on having a deal, bears no relation to the truth. Very dishonorable people to deal with. With them, there is no such thing as dealing in good faith. Amazing." Iranian state media reported Iran would not commit to giving up management of the Strait of Hormuz, and that the deal would include the release of $24 billion of Iran's frozen funds. In addition, the top administration official also saying today the specifics of how Iran's nuclear weapons program will be dismantled would come at a later time.
We will not have a nuclear weapon. They've agreed to that, which is a big part of the reason.
Is that going to be in your agreement, sir?
They will not only not have, they will not purchase, develop in any way, any shape, in any way, shape, or form, a nuclear weapon. They will not have a nuclear weapon.
Earlier this week, back-and-forth strikes pushed a shaky ceasefire to the edge of collapse. And the president warning in his post against more attacks, writing, "Also, their totally rebuffed drone attack last night against Indian ships leaving the Hormuz Strait is totally unacceptable."
If the deal happens, it's not clear where it will be signed. Logistical details are still being worked out. And that same official warned some Iranian hardliners want to kill the deal. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Even with a potential deal in sight, congressional reaction to the U.S.-Iran war is still largely divided along party lines. Most Republicans continue to support President Trump's military action, while Democrats are still calling the war illegal. For many lawmakers, the question is, what's next? Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales reports on what he's found out.
Good evening, Veronica. As Owen mentioned, the terms of the deal are still coming in at this hour, but lawmakers tell me even with an agreement, several critical questions remain. The possibility of U.S. ground troops in the region and who will control Iran's oil fields, especially Karg Island, which produces 90% of Iran's oil exports. President Trump has stated the U.S. will abandon plans to seize the strategic facility if a pending agreement is signed.
I'm worried about the move on Karg Island. I'm not saying the president's wrong, but this is how it started in Vietnam. Committing troops is it's very, very, very dramatic step.
We are indeed stuck in a bizarre quagmire where the best we can hope for is the status quo ante, getting back to a place where the Strait of Hormuz is open. That seems to be the major incentive.
Most analysts say the only way to take Karg Island, located about 15 miles off the coast of Iran, is to use ground troops, and that has lawmakers on edge.
I don't think there's ever a time in which anybody should be comfortable that there's a possibility of boots on the ground, but it is a possibility. We knew that going in. The president knew it going in. He wants to avoid that at all costs.
The last thing the country needs right now is for Donald Trump to put boots on the ground in the Middle East. That's the last thing that we need.
Republicans argue any deal must protect U.S. security.
We got to force them to want a deal with us, not the other way around. And by the way, these guys have murdered us. I've had my friends killed by these guys. I'm, 3 years in the military. They are a bad lot. We should have done this a long time ago.
Others say Iran is biding its time and President Trump must keep up the pressure.
I encourage them and the president to continue hitting Iran as hard as you possibly can until they agree, because they have televisions also, and they're trying to drag this into the midterms.
Democrats are ready. If a deal isn't finalized, they are planning to vote on another war powers resolution. And they are picking up a lot more Republican support with each vote. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
A shooting in the West Texas city of Midland has left one person dead and nine others injured. The gunfire erupted Friday morning, leading to a tense, hours-long standoff near a local animal hospital where police deployed tactical vehicles and robots. Midland Memorial Hospital reports four victims have undergone surgery while five others are in stable condition. Police say the suspect is dead. History has been made on Wall Street today as SpaceX officially went public, shattering records with the largest ever IPO. Shares opened at $150 and reached $168, pushing the company's valuation to a staggering $2.2 trillion. The massive market debut officially makes Elon Musk the world's first ever trillionaire. But it's not all clear skies. The rocket giant is still heavily burning cash, reporting an $8.7 billion loss heading into the launch. Here to discuss this major American milestone is John Hartley, a policy fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. John, great to see you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
SpaceX just made history with the world's largest ever IPO. Why are investors willing to put so much money into a company focused on rockets and space exploration?
Well, it's a historic day for SpaceX. Really, it's a company that really invented the space economy. If you sort of roll back the clock, maybe 15, 20 years ago, space was in a weird place in America. The space shuttle program was shutting down. The U.S. or the world didn't really have much going on as far as space goes, with the exception of the International Space Station. Elon Musk totally changed that. The Falcon rocket, the Dragon capsule, putting people back into space cheaply and effectively, starting to serve contracts for NASA was the beginning. And now it's a company that's pivoted into AI very quickly. It's become an AI hyperscaler very, very quickly. The acquisition of XAI earlier this year, Grok. And then on top of that, it's beginning to provide Wi-Fi to basically the entire planet, which is through Starlink. It's already got billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in revenue already. And yes, it's true that, Elon Musk is the world's first trillionaire as a result of it. But it's also important to remember that he's also made, gains for the everyday person. If you look, for example, in Ontario, the Ontario Teachers Pension Fund made $11 billion. So it's about $250,000 for every teacher. In Ontario, a province in Canada. So there's stories like this all over the place. And I think it's something that, we should be happy about. And I think this is a joyous day. There's, some people that, want to sort of take this as an opportunity to think about tax policy and things like wealth taxes. Elizabeth Warren, Ro Khanna already sort of chimed in on that. And sure, taxation, is always an important topic. But I think it's really important to just take stock, I think, of just how much of a victory this is for American innovation. Really, I think this is a company that really could only happen in America, and you have someone like Elon Musk, who's, you know, a migrant from, you know, South Africa. You know, he had a small stop over in Canada and came to the U.S. and is in many respects living the American dream, and the American people really have benefited greatly from it. And he's completely reimagined what American and the world's involvement in space can look like. And it's just amazing, just all the different possibilities that are sprouting from it.
A great American milestone, as you mentioned. Of course, a big day for Elon Musk as a trillionaire, and also for some of the retirement plans and other pension entities out there. So, John Hartley, thank you so much for breaking that all down for us.
Thanks for having me.
The historic 48-team FIFA World Cup is officially underway. Yesterday, one of the host nations, Mexico, kicked things off with an opening victory over South Africa at the Azteca Stadium. The excitement heads north today, where Canada makes its highly anticipated debut on home soil, hosting Bosnia and Herzegovina in Toronto. And finally, the U.S. men's national team takes center stage tonight in Los Angeles, looking to ride the home crowd energy in their opening group match against Paraguay. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. That's a wrap. Pope Leo heads back to Rome after his historic trip in Spain. Hear his final message to the people of Spain and the world. And a priest much beloved by our EWTN family celebrates 50 years since his ordination. We talk to Father Mitch Pacwa about his extraordinary life of ministry. Pope Leo XIV has concluded his trip to Spain, but his departure didn't go quite according to plan. As our EWTN journalists sat on the papal plane, they recorded this video of the Pope exiting the aircraft. It turns out the plane's engine couldn't start because of strong winds. The pilot said the aircraft needed to be towed and turned around. Then, a few moments later, our EWTN journalists heard this.
Ladies and gentlemen, Captain speaking, I regret to inform you that our technical crew is working to fix this issue, but it will take some time to completely resolve. For that reason, we are trying to organize to disembark the aircraft.
Thankfully, the King of Spain stepped in and offered the Holy Father a ride back to Rome on his aircraft. Before his aircraft problems, Pope Leo concluded his trip in the Canary Islands. As EWTN's Javier Romero tells us, the Holy Father had a special message for both attendees and those listening around the world.
In the Canary Islands, the Pope paid tribute to migrants and refugees who died at sea trying to reach Spain. He did so from a symbolic place, the so-called Pier of Shame. There, in 2020, amid a surge in arrivals, authorities were overwhelmed. The result, 2,600 migrants and refugees left trapped outdoors for days in inhuman conditions.
We cannot grow accustomed to counting the dead. Human dignity has no passport and does not lose its value when crossing a border.
Later, in the city of Las Palmas, he celebrated a mass for the people of the Canary Islands. They had never received a papal visit, despite Spain being one of the most visited countries by pontiffs. Perhaps one of the most representative gestures of this final leg of the trip was this.
Aujourd'hui, l'Église célèbre.
Many of the migrants come from French-speaking African countries. That is why Pope chose not to speak in Spanish, but to use their language. And he went even further. He visited the place where they sleep and greet those present one by one. The Pope sought to reach out to refugees and migrants through gestures like this, but he also reminded them that they have responsibilities in the countries that welcome them.
To you, dear migrant brothers and sisters, a noble and essential part of this journey falls to open yourselves with trust to the community that welcomes you, to learn its language, to respect its laws, to become familiar with its customs, to participate in community life, and to offer your gifts with gratitude.
The Pope's final Mass in Spain took place here at the port of Santa Cruz, a last event in which the faithful turned out in full force to show their affection for the first pope in history to visit the islands.
Right now, we're happy to welcome to the program EWTN News' Javier Romero, who joins us from the Canary Islands. Javier, you've been on the ground following the Pope throughout this historic visit. What was your favorite part of the trip?
Well, here on the Canary Islands, this was very interesting seeing and hear what the Pope said, because it was not only about talking how countries who welcome migrants and refugees has to work to integrate them, but he also asked migrants and refugees to work in order to integrate themselves on the country, to understand the laws and the culture of the country in which they arise. So that was a very interesting thing that we didn't heard for a long time. The second thing, it was, I think it could be interesting to see from my point of view, was what happened on Spain in Madrid, because we see how in Spain is losing believers. They have lost 20% of believers in the last 15 years from the last Pope papal trip, which was with Benedict XVI. But we also, what we could see on these days, how young people were joined the Pope. It was very interesting to see how the most popular artists wanted to join the Pope, to make their music in front of the Pope. That was something that we didn't see in Spain in years ago. And we are very surprised because, as I was saying, Spain is no more a Catholic country. But at the same time, we see how young people and young artists were able to want us to join the Pope on this occasion. So I think that were two interesting things that we saw on these days during this visit to Spain, Veronica.
Yes, the Universal Catholic Church is seeing a revitalization, and this also includes young people. Javier Romero, thank you so much.
Thanks to you very much.
Today marks a special milestone for Father Mitch Pacwa. He is celebrating 50 years of priesthood. For more than four decades, he's been a familiar face here at EWTN, hosting several programs that teach and discuss the Catholic faith. Father Mitch Pacwa joins me now from our Birmingham studios. Welcome, Father, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
So tell us, what does this 50th anniversary of your priesthood mean for you?
That I still have more work to do. 50 years is a good start, but that's all the way I see it, is a good start. No matter what happens, I keep having sinners coming out my ears. Plus, every day the ignorant get born, so I have lots of work to do.
What are some of the most special moments of being a priest and maybe even also a TV host that stand out to you through these decades?
I think the best part of priesthood has been being invited into a lot of very intimate moments in people's lives. And I consider the most intimate moments being those times I've spent with people who are dying. Though there's nothing more important than preparing for death. This is something where you want to talk about final exam of life. This is where you're getting ready to meet our Lord. And those times I've been with people who are preparing to die, some of whom were not always so ready. You know, some of those folks had been away for a while, and they realize, you know, sometimes late in life that God was missing. And as a result, they wanted to have very important conversations. But it's not only those times of helping to reconcile people coming to the end of their lives. There's an intimacy in people's lives throughout. You know, for instance, to the other extreme, at the beginning of life, being there with people who are preparing for marriage. And they let me get involved in asking them very poignant questions about their relationship and how ready they are for marriage. Some of them have spent more time preparing for the wedding party than they did for living with each other.
You and your ministry have been such a blessing for so many people, especially as you just highlighted those important sacraments. You were also there not too long after EWTN launched with Mother Angelica. What are some of your reflections on your journey with the network?
I was someone who was able to help keep a certain kind of teaching. I had, this background in scripture. I was able to give that. And it's been a real delight. The other thing, too, being from Chicago, I'm pretty much of a wise guy. Mother and I formed a matched set. We would tease each other and have a lot of fun and play off of each other, because she was a wise guy, too. And this was part of the fun. This was definitely part of the fun of being here with her.
Father Mitch Pacwa, again, congratulations, and thank you so very much.
No, thank you. Appreciate it.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Adoration Dedication. Learn about the newly dedicated Adoration Chapel in Pennsylvania that is being named an official shrine. We speak to the voice behind the project. New Perpetual Adoration Chapel in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia just opened today on the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart and has been dedicated by Archbishop Nelson Perez. As an official archdiocesan shrine, it's the only Perpetual Adoration Chapel serving the Delaware Valley. Named after the Sacred Heart, it's the largest in the Archdiocese and is on the campus of St. Denis Church in Havertown, Pennsylvania. We're happy to welcome to the show Ward Fitzgerald, CEO of the I Am the Vine Foundation, who also helped start the Adoration Chapel project. Ward, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So first, tell us about how this idea to have a perpetual Adoration Chapel in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia came about.
Well, I am the voice of the story today, but all of the credit goes to my wife, Kathy Fitzgerald. Kathy conceived approximately 3 years ago the idea that we would build a chapel for the fact that there were 12 parishes in Philadelphia within about a 3-mile radius that did not have perpetual adoration. And she felt that not only should we build one that was accessible to one of our nearby parishes, where it's not even our home parish, St. Denis in Havertown, but also that 10 or 11 or 12 others could be part of a collaboration to bring perpetual adoration to the Delaware County main line area of Philadelphia.
And having those intimate moments of quiet with Jesus is so important. Can you tell us what was the driving vision behind the physical features of the space, and how do you see it serving not just the local Havertown community, but also, as you said, the Delaware Valley, the Archdiocese, as a whole?
Well, one of the things that just happened last week is that the building was so magnificent when completed that the Archbishop decided to decree it a shrine of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. So Archbishop Nelson Perez will be presiding today over the dedication of the chapel to become a shrine for adoration. The building and the vision behind the building was my wife's immense talent. I mean, humbly, we know that she's been given great gifts by the Holy Spirit, and she's a vessel for the Spirit to bring Christ and the Sacred Heart to the world. The vision was to make a place that was beautiful, comfortable, because we not only want people to be at peace when they're talking to the Lord because of the beauty around them, we also want to attract people that aren't going in the church today. There was a concept that was made known to us, the concept of the courtyard of the Gentiles, those people that weren't allowed to go into the temple during the time of Christ. And because of that, we felt that an adoration chapel was a way to bring meditation, conversation with the Lord without technically participating in the sacraments. And many people, they're either members of the church and don't participate in the sacraments, or They're not members of any church, but they still, their hearts are restless. And as St. Augustine said, our hearts will remain restless until they rest in the Lord. And Kathy had this concept that if we create a beautiful space, both outdoor courtyards and the indoor chapel, that we would be able to hopefully bring people to the Lord that are not speaking with him today.
A truly incredible testament to faith that you, Ward, and your wife, Kathleen, have put together. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you very much. We're happy to share it. We hope you'll come visit Havertown, Pennsylvania.
We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night, and God bless.